From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made last Tuesday when Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas signaled a desire to take apart one of the landmark decisions in American history. The case was Times v. Sullivan, a 1964 decision that deals with libel. At the core is the very practice of a free press, because without Times v. Sullivan, it's possible that wealthier citizens could sue journalists for publishing stories they don't like. Times v. Sullivan found that the Constitution creates a higher barrier for public figures to claim libel. Justice Thomas is calling for this decision to be reconsidered now, and he had some harsh words as well. He addressed Times v. Sullivan because the Supreme Court was considering whether to take up the case of a woman who accused Bill Cosby of sexual misconduct in 2014. Her name was Catherine McKee. She was one of Bill Cosby's many accusers. And at the time, she talked to the New York Daily News. Well, Cosby's lawyer then told the Daily News that McKee was a liar. She sued for defamation, and she lost her case. And the Supreme Court denied her a hearing because, according to the standard set by Times v. Sullivan, McKee, the accuser, had become a public figure and could only win a defamation suit if she could show actual malice on the part of the Daily News. Now, maybe you think it's unfair that someone like Catherine McKee, who said she was assaulted by Bill Cosby, would be deemed a public figure. That's what the court had to decide. And that's when Justice Thomas took the opportunity to blast Times v. Sullivan. Justice Thomas wrote, quote, "If the Constitution does not require public figures to satisfy an actual malice standard in state law defamation suits, then neither should we." And he goes on to write, quote, "We did not begin meddling in this area until 1964, nearly 175 years after the First Amendment was ratified. The states are perfectly capable of striking an acceptable balance between encouraging robust public discourse and providing a meaningful remedy for reputational harm. We should reconsider our jurisprudence in this area," end quote. And this viewpoint lines up neatly with the views of President Donald Trump, who has repeatedly called for a significant change in libel laws. The president has said that, for example, when the New York Times writes a story that he thinks is unfair or untrue, he should be allowed to sue for libel. Journalists are deeply concerned about how such a change in the law could impact their work. This hour, a conversation about what Times v. Sullivan tells us and what a change might entail. Our guests this hour include Chris Thomas, a partner with Nixon Peabody, whose work entails a lot of work when it comes to media and free speech and the like. I'm rambling now. Something like that. Lots of stuff, right?
Lots of stuff.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. It's always nice to talk to you about these matters.
Good to be here.
Andrea Hickerson's director of the School of Communication at RIT. Welcome back. Thank you for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
When it comes to Times v. Sullivan, Chris, I'm going to start with you on the legal side of this. I asked at the outside of the hour, right at the top at noon, if our listeners think of Supreme Court decisions that come right to mind. I'm not sure Times v. Sullivan comes to mind unless you're a journalist. Maybe it does, but I don't know. But
It doesn't.
Okay.
For regular people, it doesn't.
Okay.
What does Roe v. Wade?
Yeah, of course.
You know, and I'm so glad that you raised this because even though it's a decision we don't think about on a daily basis, it is something that we are affected by every single day when we read stories from mainstream media. It is the backbone and the bedrock of today's, well, journalism over the last 55 years. And it has been completely non-controversial for 55 years. It is a decision that is widely beloved in the legal community. There are very few voices other than a couple of loud voices, well, one loud voice in particular, the president's, and now Justice Thomas weighing in and saying, hey, maybe we ought to take a look at this. But we don't think about Times versus Sullivan on a regular basis because it is so ingrained and so widely accepted as being critical to the functioning of our democracy.
And let me ask both of you, and Chris, to follow that point. I don't want our listeners to mistake the idea, well, that Times v. Sullivan is only about people who would sue for libel. It's about all of us being able to consume information, isn't it, Chris?
Oh, exactly. You know, click on CNN, click on Fox.
How about NPR?
Pick on NPR, you know, and I'm saying, you know, click on,
yeah.
You know, not pick on, but click on. And any article that you read there just about, ask yourself, well, if I was on the receiving end of this article, could I take umbrage at something that's said in it? And if the answer is, well, yeah, I could make up some argument as to why I could take umbrage of it, now I'm going to sue. Well, guess what? If that was the in the mind of the publisher, say NPR or Fox, that every time they wrote an article about an individual, including a public official, it could come back to bite them because the official took umbrage to it, do you think you'd be reading that article? No.
And probably in regards to President Trump, we'd be seeing a lot less as well, right?
Far less. It's not even a question. Far less.
Okay. Andrea Hickerson, I know this must come up with students. How high on the list is Times v. Sullivan on important cases in your mind?
I think that is the one case that all journalism students would know for sure that comes up, you know, even in the basic reporting and writing one class. And it's, you know, I think journalists see it as foundational, right, as a checks and balances on the government essential to their function as the Fourth Estate. If they felt that they couldn't report freely, particularly on the government, then we wouldn't have a free press.
When it comes to the coverage of this administration, you have, well, most politicians and most politically elected leaders in this country are pretty wealthy, though not all. And wealth can also accrue power. So this is about reputational damage. It's also about power. What do you think would change if we saw Times v. Sullivan essentially wiped out, Andrea? What's the first concern that you have that comes to mind?
I think it would have an immediate chilling effect on the reporting that would go on. People would be less critical of the government for fear of repercussions. I think we'd see a lot of lawsuits, and I think we'd see a lot of these really new independent publishing models coming out be squashed because they don't have the legal fees to fight this stuff, even if it finds out what they were doing was true. So it basically gives, I think, more power to the already powerful and already wealthy.
And, you know, at the risk of it sounding like a history lesson, I want both of our guests just to remind us what Times v. Sullivan was about. I'll start with Chris here. Give us a little history lesson now.
Okay, so turn the clock back to the 1950s. The country is absolutely on fire with the civil rights movement. And in the lead up to New York Times versus Sullivan, you had 1954 Brown versus Board that integrated the Topeka schools. You had Rosa Parks in 1955 and the Montgomery bus boycott. You had Emmett Till getting murdered in 1955. You had the Little Rock Nine in 1957. You had the Freedom Riders in 61. You had James Meredith integrating UMass in 62. And then you had MLK getting jailed in Birmingham, you had Medgar Evers getting killed, and you had the I Have a Dream speech in 63. Our nation was on fire. Meanwhile, what happened was there was an advertisement placed in the New York Times in which prominent leaders, including Harry Belafonte, MLK, Eartha Kitt, just the pantheon of African-American social leaders of the day, signing a document that went into a full-page ad in the New York Times that essentially said, we're getting killed down here. We are getting hammered. Here are the things that are going on with Dr. King. Here's the things that are going on with kids at school. They're getting beaten. They're getting arrested. They're getting, whooped up on. And we need money to help fund our legal defense and to help fund the defense of Dr. King. They post it in the New York Times, a paid ad, and there's a couple of facts that were wrong. One of the facts was they said that Dr. King had been arrested 7 times. Well, in fact, he had just been arrested 4 times. Another one was that they alleged that the police had ringed the university campus when, in fact, they had just positioned themselves in front of the university campus. Those tiny little inconsistencies or inaccuracies, if you will, served as the basis for a libel suit brought by Sullivan against New York Times, saying that he had been libeled by those, even though his name wasn't even mentioned in the advertisement. What happens? He, and this is part of the lawyer craft that went on, he and his lawyers sued an Alabama state court. Why did he sue an Alabama state court? Because he was going to hometown the New York Times. And how did he end up doing that? Well, everyone says, well, New York Times is in New York. They need to be sued in federal court in New York. That's not the case. Lawyers on a regular basis, every day in this nation, try to pick the venue that is most beneficial for them and their client. And that's what the lawyers for Sullivan did. What they did was they said, where are we going to get a better shake? New York? Hell no. Or I'm sorry for saying that. Heck no.
It's okay. It's on the edge.
Okay.
No. We'll allow it, Counselor.
We're going to be way better off in front of our segregationist judge, Walter Jones, here in Alabama. And so what did they do? They defeated the ability to go to federal court with a procedural sleight of hand, which we use every day. And it's not, and I say sleight of hand, it's absolutely legal and permissible. You add defendants to the case that are from the state where you want to be. So in this case, what did Sullivan's lawyers do? They added Ralph Abernathy, Joe Lowry, and Ralph Shuttlesworth, all Alabama defendants, to the suit against the New York Times. That prevented the Times from getting to federal court because you had Alabamians there as defendants as well. So they end up in front of Judge Jones. Judge Jones is an ardent segregationist, and he completely ran a train over all of the defendants. What was the upshot of it? The upshot was the Times was hit by a $500,000 jury verdict, which today equates to about $3.5 million. And each of the individual defendants were also hit with the individuals being Abernathy, Lowry, Shuttlesworth, were hit with massive penalties as well, $500,000. And this is exactly what the issue is. The Sullivan immediately took the judgment that he obtained and put liens on the cars and the houses and the real estate, anything that these ministers owned, which was not much, but you know, when you're getting by on not much, everything matters. They attached the bank accounts. The New York Times, of course, had deeper pockets than that and said, whoa, yeah, we're not playing that game. And through a really amazing set of lawyering by a guy named Herb Wexler, who was their counsel for years and a real First Amendment visionary, he figured out a way to move the case on appeal, the eventual appeal, to the federal court system. Why do people in hostile environments want to be in the federal court system? Simple, because federal judges aren't elected after every 8 years or 10 years or 12 years. They have lifetime appointments. And for that reason, they are less likely to be swayed by the common passions of the day. And they were lucky that that happened, that they were able to do that because they were able to get it into the federal court system and right up to the Supreme Court, which was paying very close attention and had in the years prior to Sullivan had been making decisions that were far more egalitarian, that were saying, hey, look, we do need to desegregate our schools, hence Brown versus Board of Education, right, as an example. And that is what started the process of bringing Times versus Sullivan up to the Supreme Court. And that is the historical setting, probably other than our revolution when we were fighting the British, probably the time and the Civil War, the time of the most social tumult in our nation's history. That was the setting. That was those were the conditions precedent to the Warren Court taking on New York Times versus Sullivan, a case that they were not obligated to take. It was not a case that was mandatorily required by statute or procedure for the court to take. They did it because they wanted to make a statement. It was an exercise of their what we call certiorari prerogative.
And they ended up making a unanimous decision.
It was unanimous. And the reason that's important is that other cases in and around that time that dealt with issues related to civil rights were not always unanimous. I think some people, well, most of us don't even remember the history. I mean, I was born in 64, so, you know, I wasn't cognizant of much until, you know, probably 75. But we don't remember that that's where it came from. And what it makes me think of is that the bard wrote in one of his plays, Pass his prologue. And I think that that's kind of where we're getting to now. We don't have the same kind of tumult in our society as we had between the 1940s and the mid 1960s. But we're getting to a different point in time where having a president with, you know, the unique skills and abilities that he has to focus public attention on different issues is bringing New York Times versus Sullivan, you know, back into light, where it's just been essentially taken as a fait accompli, as just a bedrock issue for 55 years, unquestionable.
Okay, and Andrea, let's make sure we put a little bow on this, that where libel kind of finishes the story here, and why libel, the question of what libel is, has been so impacted by this decision.
Sure. I mean, I think that the big thing, the big takeaway, or the many, as Chris just pointed out, is that if people are in power, that if they're prominent figures, then they have to have a higher standard, and that truth is the greatest defense here. And actually what these reporters were doing was the truth, and that should be protected. So it relates back to this idea of, your reputation, and you should be able to defend your reputation, and that people that have more power are considered public figures. The press has more liberty, I guess, to write about these people, because they have to have it. They would have to show actual malice.
Evan, before we jump on, so just to further add to the context of what was going on, there had been a concerted effort in the South to attack news outlets in this way, using libel laws to prevent news outlets from across the nation from publishing stories about what was going on in the South. And at the time that New York Times v. Sullivan was decided, there was over $300 million in outstanding libel judgments that had been obtained by generally rich and powerful white Southerners against news organizations. So the court took that into consideration as well. The concerted weaponization of state libel law across the South, and said, wait a second, something's going on here and we've got to address it.
Okay. And so as our guests have said, it has been relatively uncontroversial until now. And I want to read a little bit more of what Justice Thomas had to say, just to kind of bring you back into what Clarence Thomas is saying about this landmark decision, this 55-year-old decision that at least has stood the test of time until now. He's calling for a reexamination of Times v. Sullivan, and he says that that if the Constitution does not require public figures to satisfy an actual malice standard in defamation suits, then neither should we. He says the states are perfectly capable of striking a balance between encouraging robust public discourse and providing a meaningful remedy for reputational harm. End quote. And President Trump has talked about reputational harm many times. In fact, he just tweeted not too long ago, "Isn't it a shame that someone can write an article or a book, totally make up stories, and form a picture of a person that is literally the exact opposite of the facts and get away with it without any retribution or cost? Don't know why Washington politicians won't change libel laws," end quote. So that's from President Trump. So it does sound like Justice Thomas and President Trump have some agreement here. So let's hit a couple of points here. Andrea, when Clarence Thomas argues that can't we strike a balance, can't each state strike their own balance, we don't need to have an actual malice standard. And if somebody decides, look, Andrea Hickerson, you wrote a story about me, even if you weren't malicious, maybe you were lazy, maybe you were just negligent, maybe you're a bad reporter. Well, anyway, you wrote a story about me, it's largely untrue, my reputation is harmed, and I'm going to sue you. And I should be allowed to sue you. Why do I have to prove actual malice? That's part of what Justice Thomas seems to be arguing. What do you make of that?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the state's argument is really interesting, particularly in light of what Chris was saying about the history of this and how that became a weapon. And I think that the history that Chris said shows that we can't leave it to the states, that the federal part is super important in this particular case. And Chris and I were talking before, too. It's interesting about New York because, you know, I think that, you know, we have shield protections here in places that we don't. So I would think that in New York that this wouldn't be as much of an issue. A legislation would come along. But again, I think it shows that there is this gamesmanship. And I think that that's the danger, is that people would play this game to take court cases in states where it might be, I guess, less lenient or more more open to libel claims. So I think it's hugely dangerous.
I mean, I think of, for example, my first job in journalism was in West Virginia. Don Blankenship's a name that gained some national press recently, ran for U.S. Senate, also spent a year in prison. A lot of people think he should have spent more. He was the CEO of Massey Energy, one of the biggest energy companies in West Virginia. And when you drive down the interstate in West Virginia, there are billboards that say coal keeps the lights on. And a lot of the people in the DEP, which is their version of our DEC, have ties to the coal industry, just as many people in the U.S. EPA now have ties to energy industries. And Don Blankenship's a very powerful person. If libel laws were different, he could sue the Charleston Gazette. He could sue the Daily Mail there. If they write a story about his work or Massey Energy's work. I mean, I remember one of my first stories when I was this sort of wide-eyed reporter was about these massive coal slurry impoundments and how it doesn't seem like they always follow the rules on safety. And why is that allowed? Well, libel, changing the libel laws, I would think, gives a multi-millionaire, someone like Don Blankenship, much more more of an ability to say, that story is not going to run.
Exactly. I like that example a lot. I particularly like the part about the billboard, right? Because the whole rationale is that if you are a famous person already, you have the ability to manipulate that message or put your own message out to counter what a smaller independent news organization might to do instead. So they can, they have the opportunity to kind of counter that harm and have people automatically listen. Where, you know, there are different protections if it's, you know, somebody down the street and there's a negligent report about that. You know, there are circumstances where they could seek damages, but again, you know, negligence, actual malice, is a really important distinction.
Okay. Chris, what do you make of Justice Thomas saying actual malice, if there's nothing in the U.S. Constitution, then we don't need to apply that, that this is something worth revisiting, and why can't we let the states strike their own balance?
Well, I'll just reiterate. The states have proven that they're not capable of striking a reasonable balance. That's why New York Times versus Sullivan was introduced or was decided in the first place. Alabama was just, well, all of the states across the South were allowing libel laws to be weaponized against less powerful people. The other thing is, you know, law is just a way that we decide to govern ourselves. You know, it's not as though, you know, the founders came down from Mount Sinai and said, you know, here's the Constitution, and it's perfectly detailed. You know, in fact, you know, the Ten Commandments aren't even perfectly detailed. You think, you know, well, the first one is no God before me. Well, you could hear Moses saying, well, how about a God just beside you or one after you? You know, well, there's ambiguity even in a document that we kind of take as being talismanic and all important.
You are my favorite lawyer for literally bringing in the Ten Commandments. Well, here's what Moses must have been thinking.
Here's another thing. And I have this sort of view of Moses being played by Woody Allen. And the other one is like, honor the Sabbath, right? That's there. And Moses saying, what? How about football? There's going to be this football thing in the future. Are people allowed to watch football? The simple point that I'm trying to make in a humorous way is that when we have texts are open to interpretation, and it is dependent upon the person who is interpreting it. And in this instance, let's talk about the two people who are the ones who are talking about this the most, Donald Trump and Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas is famous for what line during his confirmation hearing? This is a high-tech lynching. Okay, the high tech he was talking about was the media. This is a man who has an experience with the media and with his perception of libel that he was libeled that he has an axe to grind over. The same thing is true with Donald Trump virtually every hour. There is no one who is more engaged with the media and in media than Donald Trump, yet he wants to have a, you know, some sort of standard by which he gets to approve what gets written about him. My point is simply this. Documents get interpreted by people, and people have agendas. It's something both of you use and teach your students every day. You know, Andrew, you teach your kids that every day.
Mm-hmm.
And Evan, when you're pressing back on people who, you know, are maybe being evasive or whatever, you're recognizing that these people have biases about...
I can recognize it because I'm the only one who doesn't have an agenda.
Oh, yeah, right.
I think it's an important point.
Here's my point, that there's ambiguity in the Constitution. The founders put that ambiguity... The founders could have done something that is done every single day of the year in legislatures and among bodies of politicians and legislatures across the nation. They could have been more specific. You know, every day lawyers read statutes and they go to the section of examples. Here are some examples of what we're talking about as legislators. The founders didn't do that. They didn't say, well, we really do want to leave this to the states. You know, we think this can only be decided by the states. They left it open. So while Clarence Thomas is saying that it's not mentioned in the Constitution, nor is it forbidden in the Constitution. And what does that do? It leaves a space for today's legislators and judges to think about what it is that fits us now and that does not do damage to the language of the Constitution.
All right, one more point on this then, and then we're going to get to some of your feedback. And listeners, we've already got some emails, some questions for our guests as we talk about not just Thomas v. Sullivan, but Justice Clarence Thomas and his remarks last week criticizing Thomas v. Sullivan and indicating that there is at least an opening in his mind to reexamine libel laws in this country. It's exactly what President Trump wants to see happen. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255. It's 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email us, as some of you are already doing, at connections@WXXI.org. Writing for the Daily Beast, Jay Michelson had a piece titled Clarence Thomas is Gunning for Thomas v. Sullivan. And in his view, his analysis is this is about originalism. And let me read from Michelson's analysis here. He writes, quote, essentially, Justice Thomas's argument is originalism on steroids, because when the First Amendment was adopted in 1791 and later extended to the states by the 14th Amendment, public figures could sue for libel. So, therefore, they should be able to now. End quote. I'll ask both of you. You're not a big fan of the terms originalism kind of bothers you in some sense. Why?
Originalism, you know, textualist.
Yeah.
These are terms that people use as a heuristic. And it is basically, and by what I mean by that is it's a shorthand to say, you know, and I'm going to put on my, you know, pompous voice here. I'm an originalist. Therefore, I am closer to what the founders thought. And because I'm closer to what the founders thought, anything that you say is wrong and stupid. I don't like that term originalist because I think it tries to get a head start on a discussion that is not necessarily appropriate.
I think you don't need to warn us that that voice is meant to be something. Okay. It was very effective.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Do you agree, Andrea?
About the textualists?
Yeah, I mean, again, I know Chris, working in the legal field, is going to be thinking about this a little bit more than you and I will. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the argument here that, well, hey, in 1791, people could sue, why wouldn't we allow that same sort of standard today?
Right. Well, one thing I like to tell my students all the time is this is America. You can always sue, right? Now, whether or not you're going to win is really different. And so that remedy is there, right?
You're criticizing
if you just
Chris
want to do that.
And his ilk.
Thank God for that. Yeah. As long as you're paying the bill.
So that threat is there. It's the fact that we have a really high standard that you're actually going to win these lawsuits for libel is what keeps a lot of these cases from going to court in the first place. And that's really important, I think, to distinguish.
All right. Bill and Geneseo, we'll take your call first after the break. And we've got your emails to work through as we talk about what happens going forward in regards to not just Thomas v. Sullivan, libel law in this country, what the president wants, what the Supreme Court might do, and how that it could impact journalists across the country. You just heard Andrea Hickerson, director of the School of Communication at RIT. Chris Thomas is a partner with Nixon Peabody, and we are right back to your phone calls and emails next. Coming up in our second hour, the city of Rochester has released guidelines for neighborhood associations. Essentially, the guidelines are designed to say this is what a neighborhood association is and this is what it's not. And if you are part of a neighborhood group, this is about whether your voice is included or not. Now, some say this is the right thing to do for the city to move forward and set these standards. Others say their voices are being excluded. We examine it. Welcome back to Connections. It was during the presidential campaign that President Trump was overt about his desire to see, in his word, in his words, the loosening of libel laws. And now Justice Clarence Thomas is indicating he thinks the landmark libel law decision, Times v. Sullivan, dating back 55 years, he thinks it's time to revisit it. He thinks it's flawed in many ways. I don't think, Chris Thomas, he's got the votes to pull this out. Let's just say something gets to the Supreme Court that would give him that open door. I don't know that he's got four colleagues on the court that would join him, do you?
Maybe not yet, but, you know, RBG is getting up there, and there's always the possibility that, that there could be the number of votes available.
So in other words, this isn't just a fruitless conversation that, is sort of all based on hypothetical. We should be taking this seriously.
Absolutely. When you have, you know, one of the judges of the highest court saying we ought to take a look at it, what is he doing? He's signaling. He's signaling to the community at large. He's signaling to the president that he's hearing his message. He's probably also signaling to his spouse, who has taken some very right-wing positions on many things. And he's also signaling to other to lawmakers in Congress. So this is serious to put something in a decision as he did.
Okay, Bill and Geneseo on the phone first. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, so I just have a question by way of curiosity. So I'm all for freedom of the press, but I get so weighted down and sick of hearing the news because all it's talking about is particular politicians. And I'm curious if overturning Times versus Sullivan might actually make journalism more interesting to the degree that journalists would be forced to talk more about subject matter than the people involved. And so it's not really a comment about whether or not it should be overturned or not, but I'm just curious if talking about the positivity of good issues and then saying where a person may or may not stand without actually addressing the individual themselves would make for better journalism.
Okay. Andrew, what do you think?
Sure. I think it would be nice if people could focus on the facts. I think the big problem now is that so much of what is labeled news is actually opinion. And opinion, it would not be, it has to be a fact in order to be involved in a libel lawsuit. So I don't think actually that it would change, and arguably it could hurt if it just becomes more, well, it's just my opinion, this. You know, we want more facts-based journalism. But I agree with the critique that so much of what we hear in the news now is just focused on a couple of major news stories, and it's harder to get other things out.
Okay. Bill, thank you for the phone call.
And I'm not sure, Evan, how you actually end up being able to separate subject matter from the people who are driving those subjects. You know, I think that, you know, as I said before, law is about how we govern ourselves. So if we have government officials taking certain positions and driving those positions, they are, by definition, part of the story.
Okay. Well, here's Tim who writes, he says, I'm a little confused. What happens now when newspapers misrepresent and or outright lie about public figures? Do they have, in other words, do the public figures have any legal ability to collect damages? And Tim goes on to say, I'm sure someone like Anita Hill would have loved to collect damages for what she suffered. She certainly had reputational damage. That's from Tim. All right, Chris Thomas, why don't you lead us off there? What happens now, he says, when newspapers misrepresent or outright lie about public figures?
Generally speaking, they get a pass. And the reason that they get a pass is because of New York Times versus Sullivan, which says that there has to be proven actual malice, which is an exceedingly difficult thing to prove or demonstrate. And in New York Times versus Sullivan, Justice Brennan specifically recognized that this was going to happen and basically said, we need to give the media elbow room to say things that sometimes are going to be incorrect. Now, the issue of an outright lie is slightly different because that is something that can serve as the basis for a lawsuit if it's demonstrated that it was an outright lie as a result of actual malice. The editor had an axe to grind against the, you know, the town legislator or something like that.
Okay. Do you have anything to add there, Andrea, in terms of the way it's currently set up? I mean, I think Chris is right. Most of the time you get a pass. Some of our listeners might think, well, you shouldn't get a pass. What do you want to add there?
I mean, I think just that, you know, proving intent is really difficult. And I would add, too, that journalists don't have an incentive to lie. because if they're truly serving the public, right, you want to get the facts that are out there, because you lose your credibility, you lose your audience. So proving that intent is hard. I mean, and this is different than mistakes. Like, mistakes happen. Yeah. And oftentimes, you know, media organizations acknowledge mistakes and they print a correction and those things happen. So negligence is different, but it's just a really high standard to prove that it was intentional that they said this negative thing.
I think that's such an important point that the professor is raising here, because I think some listeners might say, well, look at, and I'll use sort of an old cliche by now, Fox News versus MSNBC, you know, one right, one left, fair or not, whatever. You know, some of those people are making claims, even reporters on those networks are making claims that they know might not be true, or that might serve a narrative. I actually think in this case, it is more likely that what would serve us all better is a little bit more training with motivated reasoning, confirmation bias, understanding how we view the world through our own biased lens as reporters, journalists, talk show hosts, etc., as opposed to malicious lies. Most of the time what I see, whether it's Fox, MSNBC, or elsewhere, is motivated reasoning. What do you think?
I think so. And I mean, another way to look at it too is there's some news organizations, and I know NPR was one for a while, that didn't want to call Donald Trump a liar, right? And yeah. So that same rationale is that, well, we don't really know what his intent was, and you need to know intent in order to use that particular word. Another kind of analogy in media law is proximate cause. Like, how would you know that watching a violent video led to this violent action? That's really, really hard to prove. But yet every time there's a major tragedy, you know, we're always looking to blame, oh, they played this video game before they committed this crime. And that's a really high standard to get into those kind of psychological motivational issues.
Yeah. Okay. Michael is an attorney who writes to us to say, Evan, thanks for the great show on this. Does the concept of equal time have any relevance to today's discussion? Chris?
No.
I didn't think so.
Mm-mm. I mean, I don't know if Michael is saying that, you know, there ought to be voices at this table that are in favor of rolling back New York Times versus Sullivan, or if there should be a subsequent program where you bring in, the president or Clarence Thomas.
So actually, let me take this two ways, because I hadn't even thought thought of it as a critique of this hour. I would love to have someone in this room who is in favor of, I would love to have Justice Thomas in this room. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
It's harder to find people to come on this program and defend rolling back a landmark libel law.
That has been completely non-controversial until recently.
Yeah, but I'm sure there are some people who would do it. I don't know any journalists. I don't know a single journalist who agrees with Clarence Thomas on this, agrees with President Trump on this. I don't know attorneys who do. But I would welcome that. To Michael's point on equal time, I think there's two separate issues beyond just today's show that come to my mind. We always do our best to sort of get as equal as we can get on an issue. We don't always succeed. And I promise you, we work harder on it than you possibly know. A lot of late nights and a lot of phone calls and emails that sometimes don't get returned. But I think what he's also saying is, well, forget a lie about somebody. Let's say Andrea and I are running against each other for an office. And Chris's newspaper, writes a bunch of stories that are critical of me. They don't, and most of the coverage is about me, and most of it's negative. There's very little coverage about her, but to the extent there is, it's positive. Or just say all the coverage is about her and it's all positive. None of it's about me. Can I sue in any regard there?
No.
And the answer is no.
No. No. You know, it's interesting, though. I don't know if they still do it or not. USA Today used to have the point counterpoint on their opinion page. And that's almost a recognition of what it is that Michael's asking about. And I guess they decided at some point that they wanted to do, some people say X, other people say Y,
yeah.
And they would print it on in their editorial page. But in terms of, the content of a the newsroom of any organization, the answer is no, and courts are never going to meddle in that. That's so First Amendment protected that it's not going
to
happen.
That has to be a public debate about what we expect of journalists and newsrooms. But at the same time, Andrea, and I'm sure this comes up with your students, you don't want to just tell prospective journalists and young journalists cover everything quote-unquote equally. And I know that drives some of our listeners, because the truth is not always equal.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and this comes up kind of to your earlier point about selective bias and reading things what we want to see. So there's always these studies about, oh, look, you know, 80% of the coverage of Donald Trump, for argument's sake, is negative. And but how do you measure that, right? Like, how do you measure that that's there? And then there's also, you know, the bias towards incumbents. So there's always going to be more coverage of an incumbent, and that could be a bit more critical because we can critique their policies. They've got stuff that are out there. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of a false dichotomy, like telling even the old critique, you know, telling both sides of the story. What if there are not two equal sides, you know, so that implies some kind of levity to both sides that may not be there in a particular case.
Sure. But this is an issue for Andrea and her students to tangle with and for newsrooms to tangle with, not for the law. Michael, thank you for the email. Dave writes to us and say, would an overturn of Times v. Sullivan put us in a similar legal regime with regards to defamation as Britain, and how terrible is their system? We hear a lot about this, Counselor Thomas. Is it bad over there? I think Americans think in Great Britain, you can sue anybody for any reason, and it's just like the Wild West of the law.
Well, I'm no expert on the law in England, but what I do know is I used to be a competitive cyclist, and you know, Lance Armstrong was, of course, my idol. And
how long did that last?
As my idol?
Yeah.
Until probably the fifth Tour de France when it was obvious that he was doped to
the
gills.
Okay.
So anyways, there were books written about him and people spoke about him, people that had specific and actual and direct knowledge of his doping. And what did he do? Did he sue here in the United States? No, of course not. He did what's called libel tourism. And libel tourism is a, you know, a long-honored tradition where Americans who are upset by something that is written and that will come over to the U.S. and, you know, make them uncomfortable or they'll take umbrage to, is instead sue in England. And, you know, he got a massive judgment in England and was subsequently found to be just a tremendous liar. And this is one of the, you know, one of the reasons why I think New York Times versus Sullivan is such a valuable piece of jurisprudence.
Yeah, I think the Lance Armstrong story is a really good one to point to for this, and actually for more reasons than one, because I remember, you know, if Lance Armstrong wants to sue when people are sort of bringing up doping allegations and say he's essentially trying to silence any allegations, and as Chris points out, he was successful in this libel tourism in doing that. On the other side of that, what I don't know is whatever happened to the people who he came out, and I assume Lance Armstrong is a public figure. I assume someone who was an aide to a team or whatever the case was not a public figure, but they might have made an allegation. And Lance Armstrong went after those people really hard.
Hardcore.
He didn't just say, I'm going to sue newspapers that publish these allegations against me. He trashed the reputations of the people who made the allegations. And in my sort of totally lay analysis, he seems to have libeled them.
Oh, absolutely.
And I don't know if anybody ever sued him for libel, but let's hit an important point here and let's kind of walk through this. It was a Cosby case that put this in front of the Supreme Court last week. And it was a woman who told the New York Daily News that she had been a victim of Bill Cosby in 2014. She tells them this. She wasn't a public figure. She becomes more publicly known because of the allegation. And the court essentially says, well, you're kind of a public figure now. Well, what about somebody who makes an allegation against Lance Armstrong? If that person was just an aide to a cycling team, whatever, Team Sky, U.S. Postal, whatever it was, they're not a public figure, but they become well-known because they do interviews.
Mm-hmm.
Do they become a public figure? Does the standard change for them?
They do, yes. They can either be what's called a straight-up public figure or an involuntary public figure, because there's people, the soigneurs is the term that's used in cycling to describe the person who is kind of the aide to the rider. And one of these said, Lance is a doper. I've seen the EPO. I've seen the blood bags, so on and so forth. And, you know, he just dropped a ton of bricks on her and multiple other people. She did not want to have any involvement with it at all, other than to say, this guy's a fraud. She would have been considered in our system an involuntary public figure. She didn't want to be, but she was. Another one I think of, ripped from the headlines, is this kid, Nick Sandman. He is now an involuntary public figure. well, he was initially an involuntary public figure. Hey, I didn't do anything. Leave me alone. And now he's just a straight up public figure because now he's, you know, doing press and suing and that sort of thing.
When it comes to the Cosby case, was the Supreme Court right to say last week, Catherine McKee, who told her story to the Daily News in 2014, she became a public figure?
Yeah, it was. No two ways about it.
And I think that's hard, Andrea, for people to kind of get their heads around, because at times it's one thing to say Lance Armstrong's a public figure. Of course he is. But people who might just be an aide to a team would get pulled into the public. But in terms of the work of journalists, it's tough. People
right.
don't want to necessarily. I had never even heard the term.
Sonior?
An involuntary public figure?
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard for people to get their heads around.
I think so, because we like this idea of consent, but, you know, if you become an involuntary public figure, that's not something you agree to. So there's a big difference between an elected public official who is seeking publicity, who needs publicity to have their position of power, versus somebody who's just by circumstance becomes well known.
And it's a particularly troublesome case because this is a rape victim. You know, this is a rape victim.
Yeah.
And it makes all of us uncomfortable. And it's actually the perfect case by which Clarence Thomas could raise this issue. You know, he's not raising it on behalf of Bill Cosby. That would not have been, you know, at all PC. You know, he's raising it in the context of a rape victim of Bill Cosby.
And by the way, just to sort of put a bow on that particular case, Catherine McKee comes out in 2014, tells the New York Daily News that Bill Cosby sexually assaulted her. Bill Cosby's attorney tells the New York Daily News, this woman is a liar. It becomes a high-profile story. She sues for libel. And the New York Daily News says, look, we're just printing a quote. They're protected here, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
They are.
And it brings us back to what we were talking about earlier with the libel system. The legal system is often used to bludgeon other people. Okay, and there are discussions going on in lawyers' offices across the nation right now about how can I inflict the most pain on the other side, and it's at all levels of court that this happens. I've got a case in family court that I'm doing pro bono right now, where the opponent is without question doing that very thing. How can I inflict the most pain? The simple reality is the legal system is a human creation, and so as is the system of laws, and is open to those kinds of manipulations that people with bad intent can have. Mm.
But we can't have a situation, Andrea, where the New York Daily News can't quote Bill Cosby's attorney.
Correct. Yeah, it's a fact that he said that.
Yeah. Tess in Brighton, next on the phone. Go ahead, Tess.
Thank you for this discussion. It brings my mind back to an opportunity that I had to meet with Clarence Thomas several years ago. I had a fellowship that was given to high school history teachers from around the country, and we sat in a majestic conference room in the Supreme Court with Roger Taney and John Marshall's portrait staring down at us. Clarence Thomas came in and talked to us. He was very folksy, very charming, but he continued to refer to the two-thirds compromise. Of course, the teachers in the room all know that he meant the three-fifths compromise, that clause in the Constitution that counted slaves as three-fifths of a person. We were, of course, too polite to correct him at the time, but we all left that conference room concerned with Clarence Thomas's legal acumen.
Tess, I certainly appreciate the phone call. I wasn't there. If that's what happened, maybe it was a simple slip of the tongue, two-thirds, three-fifths, I don't know. I'm trying to be generous.
Yeah, no, she's right.
Or maybe there's another compromise I'm not aware of.
Yeah. You better not say that again, because you might get sued if New York Times versus Sullivan
don't
gets
joke, counselor. But that does, Tess, thank you for the phone call. That does, though, I tell Chris Thomas, don't joke, but let's spend our last 2 minutes talking about where we go forward here. And right after our only break of the hour, Chris Thomas said, this is not just a hypothetical. These conversations matter. And right now, Clarence Thomas doesn't, quote, have the votes if a case got to the Supreme Court that we know of that would join him. But Chris says it's not impossible that eventually, you know, maybe he could. We don't know. So what happens in the world of sort of protecting U.S. journalistic freedom if this decision goes away in any meaningful sense, what's your chief concern here, Chris? More power for the wealthy?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and, you know, and it's not just the wealthy. It doesn't cost a whole lot to bring an action in state court. A lot of people can, you know, scratch up the money to bring a state action for libel. What it will do is to be a full employment act for lawyers. You know, lawyers are going to be handling a million libel cases going forward. And, you know, good for lawyers, perhaps. I think bad for, you know, for news organizations. Very bad. The other thing that I just wanted to say, like, let's allow some reality to sort of filter in here. One of the things that I do periodically in my practice is to review stories for the Democrat and Chronicle and some other entities. The absolute number one focus is on getting it right. You know, we have specific conversations about, have you found three sources for point A, B, or C? Those kinds of discussions are happening between, well, in newsrooms themselves, between editors and reporters.
Can confirm.
And between editors and outside lawyers. It's all about that.
Andrea, final thoughts.
Yeah, I think, you know, we would lose a lot of the public discourse about holding our public officials accountable because you would be afraid to publish anything if it would get you in trouble, and particularly if it meant that you had to choose between telling the right story and then the viability of your commercial entity as a news organization.
A lot has been made about President Trump. It's not just President Trump. Look at the net worth of the U.S. Senate. Look at the net worth of the presidential contenders. There's a lot of power behind possible libel lawsuits. And I think our guests have made some very important points. We'll keep abreast of it going forward. We appreciate the time from our guests, Andrea Hickerson, director of the School of Communication at RIT, and herself, by the way, a very good journalist.
Oh,
I appreciate
you.
Her work in City and other publications. Nice
thank
having
you
here. Thank you. Chris Thomas, a partner with Nixon Peabody. Thank you, Chris.
You bet.
Also, a really good impressionist.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. More connections coming up.